You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen Wednesdays after 5 or alternate Sundays. Today, I'm really excited because our friend, Erica Bauermeister, has a new book. It's going to be published at the end of May, and it's called The Scent Keeper. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad that you came. And she's right here in the studio instead of on the phone, which is even better. Well, this book, The Scent Keeper, is a book for everyone, I think. It's a coming-of-age story. It's mysterious. It's set in our neck of the woods, but not exactly. So I think that there's lots to enjoy here. Erica is the author of 3 best-selling novels, The School of Essential Ingredients. I remember when I was at the library in Port Townsend and discovered these. Joy for Beginners and The Lost Art of Mixing. She has a PhD in literature from the University of Washington. She's taught there and also at Writer's Workshop. So you'll see her around town. She's a founding member of the Seattle 7 Writers and currently lives right here in Port Townsend, Washington. So let's talk about this exciting new book. What was the inspiration for The Scent Keeper, Erica?
Well, I had a character in Joy for Beginners that was sort of a perfume matcher, I guess is what you'd call it. And so I did a lot of research into the sense of smell at the time, and I became fascinated by it. And I thought, okay, I would like a whole book about this. And what it turned into was this idea that what if we could smell the world? What if we paid attention to our sense of smell the way, say, a dog would? You know, when I walk my dog, that dog has such a different life world, you know, understanding of detail that I can't even get near. And I thought, wouldn't it be fascinating? What if you had a child that was brought up with smell as her primary sense? You know, she's not blind. She simply, smell is the default sense as opposed to vision. And what would our world look like to her? And how would she move through it? So, you know, she had to be in an isolated spot.
You know, there's a part in this book, comes fairly near the beginning, that I'd like you to read for us, that talks about this character and her discoveries of her ability to be sensitive, more sensitive to scent. Do you think you could read those pages?
Sure. So I have to preface it a little bit. Mm-hmm. The main character is Emmeline. She is being brought up on a very isolated island by her father. They're the only two people living on this island. They live in a cabin. All the walls are made out of drawers, and each drawer there's a different scent. And her father has told her that the scents come from Jack, the scent hunter. And she has no idea who Jack, the scent hunter, is. She only knows she wants to be like him. And so she begs him and begs him, will you teach me how to be a scent hunter? And so this is the point in the book where she's getting her first real, you know, official training, I guess is what you call it. A chicken coop seemed far too ordinary for a scent hunter. But I closed my eyes and allowed the world to be overtaken by sounds. The clucking of chickens, the little puffs of their conversations, the sound of a squirrel's tiny claws scrabbling up a tree. Then I heard the latch on the chicken coop lift, and my father ushered me inside. "Breathe in," he said. "Remember, just a shallow one first." I let the air into my nose like the lap of a low tide. I smelled the sharp tang of chicken manure, the memory of summer in the dried grass. "Now," my father said, "forget your nose. Open the back of your mind. Listen to the story." I inhaled again, slow and deep, and felt the smells flood my head, so full and three-dimensional I could almost wander among them. I could smell the water in its bowl, not quite fresh, and the busy, ruffled odors of the chickens as they moved about, searching for a place to settle. I waited, pondering what a new egg would smell like. My mind started to wander, letting in the scent of the damp earth outside, the smoke slipping from our chimney. Then I pulled myself back to the task at hand. Jack would pay attention. So would I. there. In the midst of all the big, musty smells, there was something new, soft, small. Its warmth didn't move like the chickens did, but lay still like a rock soaking up the sun. Eyes still closed, I made my way carefully across the coop. The smell was clear as a beacon. I put my fingers out, swept them across the dried grass. One of the chickens pushed against my knee, and I moved her gently aside. I lowered my hands, searching. There. I came out of the coop, the egg held aloft, my grin bright and broad. I was a scent hunter, just like Jack. "And that's how you do it," my father said, smiling. I found another egg, more quickly this time, and we cooked them both for breakfast. "What's my next task?" I asked my father after we had eaten. "That one was too easy." He cocked his head at me. "Find the first day of spring," he said. If any quest required patience, that one was it. We had just started winter, and spring was an eternity away. I knew how the dark days would come and the rain would settle on our good humor until it was cold and sodden. The storms would arrive and the winds would scream and the trees would throw their branches at our roof. Winter was no time to go searching for scents. Smell and the winter were sad things moldering by the fire or curled up under the roots of trees. But Jack would do it, I told myself, and so every day I put on my jacket and went hunting. In the end, there were more smells than I ever would have thought. The rain and the fog opened them up to anyone who was paying attention. We didn't really get snow on our island, but each time the cold left and the rain came, I could smell life wanting to come back. I could hear the trees whispering, "Is it time yet?" The days grew shorter and shorter until finally the world tipped and the balance shifted back in the other direction. A change was coming. I could smell it. It was like the rustling in your dreams before you finally wake up in the morning. That gentle tug on the strings of gravity as the slack tide changes direction and starts to pull you out to sea.
So that's one of the lines that pulled me out to sea and made me really love this book. We're talking to Erica Bauermeister today, and we're talking about her new book, The Scent Keeper. And this book will awaken your senses and make you think more as you're walking around Fort Worden about what you're smelling, not just seeing. So, Erica, tell us about, there must have been something about scent in your background. What were some special scents and sense memories for you?
You know, I think I have the traditional one of my grandfather's pipe tobacco. Mm-hmm. I think we all have it. There is this perfume that my second grade teacher wore that when I smell it, I am in second grade. I know what book I'm reading. I know who's sitting next to me. I know everything. I usually have a terrible memory. But when I smell that perfume, I'm there. I couldn't describe the perfume to you. Mm-hmm. I couldn't normally tell you what that book or those other kids are. But because of the way smell works, it's the one sense that goes directly to the emotional part of your brain, bypasses intellect. And so the memories that are encoded in those scents are very vivid and three-dimensional. Probably because I haven't smelled that perfume on anyone else, it takes me directly back to that memory. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been diffused in any way.
I think that's what makes this book very interactive, because it will awaken memories in the reader as well as you uncover the mysteries and the memories of your characters. So the setting, I said that was kind of familiar, but kind of not. Where does this book take place? And are these real places?
You know, my locations are always inspired by real places, but heavily fictionalized. So I needed to find a place in the world where a father could take a very young, a baby, and raise her in isolation without anyone interfering. And, you know, that's remarkably hard to do these days. I've been taken by Vancouver Island ever since the first time I went there. But then I discovered the Broughton Archipelago, which is if you drove all the way to the north end of Vancouver Island, which is a 7-hour drive, and then you take a water taxi 2 hours east, you come into this collection of islands. It's like a Morse code of islands. They're just these little dots and dashes of land scattered all through the water. They probably are 10 full-time residents out there. I mean, it is pristine and spiritually just, it's spirituality turned into nature or nature turned into spirituality, whichever way you want to go. But it is awe-inspiring. And we spent a week kayaking up there, and it just it infused the book. It just did.
Mm-hmm. So do you have a notebook that's like those wet pages that the field that the researchers carry out to write when in the rain? And
no, but I have a very soggy paper notebook.
So some of these characters don't appear right there. There's a couple in Secret Cove. What about Secret Cove? Is that a real place?
It again is inspired by actually Telegraph Cove, which is at the very north end up near Port Hardy, kind of between Port Hardy and Port McNeil. And it's just this little blip on the map with these brightly colored cottages. It's a little more extended than Secret Cove. Secret Cove is a little smaller in the book, but I love the feel of that place and the tiny cove of it, and then how it stretches out into this amazing strait of water that just moves at incredible speeds.
And there's two important characters that live there. He's Henry, right? And Colette. And this is where the dog comes in. So tell our listeners about Dodge and Henry and Colette, because they'll want to know.
Well, okay, we have a little bit of a spoiler alert here, which is Emmeline doesn't get to stay on the island her whole life. And you've probably figured that out, or there would be no conflict or arc or whatever. Anyway, so at some point, and we won't say why, she ends up in Secret Cove. And Henry and Colette are an older couple that take her in, and they have this elderly dog called Dodge. And Dodge is Emmeline's way into this new world. She's terrified by it. I mean, if you can imagine, you know, she's never seen plumbing. She's never seen a stove that lights that isn't a wood stove. She is utterly unequipped to work in this world. But Dodge is the one entity who approaches the world the way she does, who believes in his nose and can smell good and bad people far away. And she trusts him implicitly. And he helps kind of bring her out of Henry and Colette's house into the world. Mm-hmm. And their bond is very elemental.
There's another character, kind of the yin or the yang to her character, Emmeline, which is Fisher. Mm-hmm. And so what's his special trait?
Fisher has had to learn to read micro expressions. So I did a lot of research into Paul Ekman's facial expression analysis. I did all the training to learn micro expressions. I spent months and months doing it. But I wanted to kind of show how sometimes very difficult situations inspire incredible talent. And Fisher's talent is he reads people. He's had to read people. His father is abusive. And he reads people the way Emmeline reads smells. And so they are both exceptional in that regard and find a common meeting space because of that.
We're talking to Erica Bauermeister. This is Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. And she's written a new book, for those of you who have been waiting, called The Scent Keeper. So in the prologue to The Scent Keeper, you talk about how children carry unwittingly their parents' secrets. This is a book about secrets, but that really struck me. Can you tell us some more about that and how it came into the story?
You know, in the process of writing this book, and it took me 6 years, many things happened in my personal life, one of which was that my mother died. And I think that event actually helped precipitate an underlying theme of the book, which is kind of the cognitive development that each of us has to go through from childhood, where so part one of the book is on an island. When we are small, our parents are our island. They are our reality. We believe in what they tell us implicitly. The second stage, you kind of try to separate. You try and develop your own identity, and you're often doing that in contradiction to your parents. But the third stage is you have to learn to see them as people, as human beings. And I think that that is a lot of what that line, we are the unwitting carriers of our parents' secrets, because you realize, you get to the point of adulthood and realize that your parents are or were people, and that there were things that you never knew about their lives that deeply informed who they were. And often there are these secrets that make them who they are, particularly if they are broken. Mm-hmm. And we don't know them, and yet the effects of those secrets, the effect of that brokenness makes us who we are.
This book doesn't shy away from the hard parts of life, I must say. There is ugliness and struggle, and there's abuse and tragedy and even death, but you write it in such a way that it seems natural. People have a lot of kindness towards one another and try to understand one another. It's so much more than a coming-of-age book.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, it took you a long time. So what were the difficulties, the blocks, and things that distracted you along the way?
Well, we did have a couple rough years there where we lost a lot of parents, and that mm-hmm. was difficult. But that, in the end, created a more complicated book. You know, I kind of leapt into writing this book, and usually I spend 6 months where I sit down and I let a book simmer and I do all my research and I build up an amazing head of steam and then I can't wait to write. And this time I just wanted to start writing. And so as a result, I didn't know who the voice was necessarily. All my other books have been written limited third person through a variety of characters' points of view. And I kind of did that with this. Originally, there were three points of view. There was Fisher and Emmeline and Emmeline's father. But that didn't work. And so then I went down to Emmeline and her father, and that didn't work. And then we bring in Emmeline's mother, and that didn't work. And finally, one morning, and this was 3 years into it, I woke up and Emmeline's voice was in my head. And I wrote the first chapter in just this hot lightning of it just poured out on the page. And I knew I had the voice I needed. And I'd never written a first-person single character all the way through book before. And it was an amazing experience.
That's really wonderful. Great insight into, how you think the structure is going to be one way, and mm-hmm. then it needs to come around and be another one. Mm-hmm. That's really an interesting revelation for people that are writing themselves or trying to write themselves. You can't mm-hmm. really pigeonhole how it's going to be until it starts working its way out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also Henry and Colette, and I want you to talk about them because they seem to be the most compassionate people. Mm-hmm. Were you looking to show that side of the world?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
because there are a lot of broken people in this book, and I needed a safe place, because Emmeline's world when she arrives with Henry and Colette is been blasted apart, and she has no idea what she's walking into. She has no skills, and they need her too. She is a gift in their life, and she brings changes to their lives, and I think they create one of those families that's not biological, but is perhaps more important mm-hmm. and deep-seated.
Right. It becomes almost her family of choice.
And, yes.
But she still has mysteries to solve.
Yes.
And we end up in the big city. And so tell us about the character of Emmeline's mother. How did you develop her and think about her in the book?
You know, Emmeline's mother is sort of the personification of, if you have great power, you can use it for good or ill. Mm-hmm. She is an extraordinarily talented nose, what they would call a nose. And that's the person that either makes perfumes or scents or whatever. But because she was broken as a child and growing up, she chooses to use that power to manipulate people. And she creates a very successful business doing that. That was one of the things I wanted to bring into the book, was the whole concept of scent branding. That there are, when you walk in a store, if you walk in Pottery Barn, you are smelling a signature scent. When you walk in the Westin Hotel, that is a signature scent. The casinos in Las Vegas each have signature scents. And the first one to do it was in 1992. It was a Mirage Casino, and Steve Wynn wanted to create a scent because he wanted people to stay longer at the slot machines.
Hmm.
And so they created a signature scent, smells a little bit like suntan lotion, and they tracked how long people stayed, and it extended people's stays by up to 45%. It's extraordinary what a smell will subliminally do to us.
So they don't go around and put drops of perfume on the one-armed bandit. So how does this work?
There is a technology. There are several different kinds of technology, but perhaps one of the more successful ones is one that it's like a scent diffuser. You put it in the air supply, and it diffuses molecules that are so small that they are just floating in the air.
Well, I think we all became aware of the fact that the new car smell wasn't really a new car smell. There was some kind of big story about that.
Yep.
That's the first one we knew about. I remember, Nordstrom's really smelled always really nice. You know, that there must be a Nordstrom signature scent.
Well, and they usually put the perfume counter right as you enter.
That's something. You know? Yeah, that's something.
And that is unintentional.
I know, but
they think through all these things. They really do.
This is interesting in Port Townsend because, you know, this is kind of a scentless society. You're aware of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. and so are there scents that you like to have around you, and how do you put fragrance into your life?
Well, and first off, I would say that this is a very scented environment out here because we have a very natural, we also have the paper mill. But, you know, we
that's how we know we have good smells and bad smells.
Exactly. You know, I mean, you're right in that not a lot of people wear perfume, and there is that. But I think, you know, I am deeply affected by smell, and there are very few perfumes that I can wear because they alter my mood so dramatically. So I do have certain ones that when I need to feel comfort or confidence, I'm wearing it right now. Mm-hmm. But it's got us, you know, it's this bit of citrus. There's a little more complication to it, but it's a very comforting smell for me. And I, you know, it's just for me. I'm the only one that can probably smell it. But I know how to affect my moods by using smells, and I do it regularly.
Great idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So you talk about the commercialization, and you talk about, you know, how it manipulates you for good and for bad. There's a character that's kind of tangential. You know, his name's Rene, and he's working on preserving old scents, and he talks about potentially using scent as a treatment for Alzheimer's. Is that something that you invented, or is that something that can
tell us
about
out there.
That?
I mean, smell is being used in a medical setting in many different ways. So for Alzheimer's, it's a memory trigger, and along with music, it's really very effective, and they're starting to do more serious studies. There was a study that they did where they took diabetic patients, and they gave them insulin at the same time they emitted a scent into the air. Within 4 days, you could emit the scent into the air and the patient's glucose levels would drop. Hmm. All it took was the smell. So, you know, and there are also ones where there are some hospitals where if you're going to go into surgery, they'll give you a choice of 4 or 5 smells and say, what do you want to smell when you're coming out of surgery? What is going to help you? What's going to make you feel comfortable? And you choose which one it is, and then that's what greets you. And they have remarkable results with recovery. So there are lots of applications.
So it's not so strange that sometimes I put a little bit of perfume on my pillow when I go to sleep.
No, and if it's lavender, it will help you sleep.
Okay.
And if you want to wake up in the afternoon, peppermint.
Okay. Well, maybe there should be, you know, kind of a little booklet that goes...
The how-to section of the book.
The how-to section of the book. That's wonderful. I love talking about that. So from Alzheimer's to commercial treatments, what were some of the joys of writing this book? We've talked about kind of the blocks or the distractions and the difficulties, but what did you love about this book?
You know, I always fall in love with my characters. I don't like all my characters as you. Maybe some of my characters are a little pricklier, but I loved Emmeline. I mean, no matter how hard this book was to write, and no matter how many different ways I had to come at it, no matter how many versions I had to throw out, I could never let go of Emmeline. she just, I don't know, there's something about her that maybe it was the fact that she could be broken but heal, but get past it. And I saw her as so strong and so magical in her sensory abilities. And I often write characters I wish I could be. And I both felt very protective of her and very maternal about her, but also very admiring of her. So it was an interesting place to live as a writer.
Mm-hmm. And you said that, you know, you got the idea about this character from one of your past books in The Joy.
I didn't get the idea for Emmeline herself. Okay. I got the idea for working on a whole book about scent.
Oh, I see.
And I knew I didn't want it to be the character Ava, who's in Joy for Beginners. But
right.
And so I just, in my head for about 3 or 4 years, was like, okay, how could I make a whole book out of this sense of smell? And then I got this image of this little girl in a cabin. Mm-hmm. All the lines are, you know, all the walls are lined with drawers, and in every drawer there's a scent.
I love that image. You use fairy tales a lot, too.
Yes, and it's a very fairy tale-like book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love the idea that both magic and fairy tales make us look at the world in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So the section on the island is a very magical section, and I was worried that then when I switched and she left the island, we'd lose all the magic. But the thing about it is, Emmeline sees the world so differently. And I think that's what magic is. It makes us look at the world differently. So to me, she brings magic with her into the more prosaic, our ordinary existence.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that this is not a book that I would call a book with a lot of magical realism, where all of a sudden you kind of go, oh.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that everything is very possible in this story.
Which must mean you use a sense of smell, because the people who have the hard time with it are the people who don't believe in the sense of smell.
Well, I just think that, yes, it's even if I don't really have it to the degree that these characters do, I think it's very possible that you could develop it that way. So that's why, you know, I really think that this is, you know, a fast, easy read, people might say, but there's a lot more to it.
That's always my,
yes.
When I write a book, I always try to write on a variety of levels.
Mm-hmm.
I always want to have a book that someone can just read, you know, like you're on the airplane, you need the book that's going to get you from here to New York and make that trip disappear. And you can just fall into the book and go with it, right? But then I always make sure that for those readers that want to read closely, that want to dig in, it's what I call the Easter eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things about this book is there are lines that repeat over and over and over, and each time they mean something different. And there are actually chapter titles that repeat. That's not a mistake. For someone that wants to take more time, that wants to pay as close attention to the words as I'm asking you to pay attention to smells, then there's going to be a richer level of reading there. But it isn't essential in order to enjoy the book.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking to Erica Bauermeister, and she's the author of a brand new book called The Scent Keeper. It's going to be released at the end of May of 2019. And you'll be able to find it around town, online, in your library, almost everywhere. And please join me next time when we'll talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, kptz.org. You can make a donation to the station there as well. Jacob Brown is in the booth. He's the engineer. And Carl Allen is the editor who smooths out all the rough edges. Thank you to all the volunteers and the supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. Join me next time. I'm Chris Wilson. This is Book Lovers Cafe.